making TV special.
Fellas. Made with creamy butter. Yeah.
And you know what that means?
It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
It shouldn't come as a shock. The paper won't cover rock. Another paper recycles. But then I'm on the top. The makers of melodies have become enemies. Television and radio. Tell me something I don't know. Don't believe what you read, boy. Don't believe it indeed. Tell me something but don't go.
Sloan, yet again. That's from their B-Sides collection. Tell me something I don't know. Television and radio. So appropriately enough, this is the B-Side episode of 158 from MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com. Just a little bit past 8:30 in the morning on this February 26th, 2010. And for those of you who don't know, we record what we call B-sides. When we can't cram everything into the flagship episode. So interestingly enough, not too many people, or at least not as many as download the regular show, download these B-sides. So, for those of you, either new or returning, welcome. And what we're going to do here, and what we tend to do on the B-side episodes, is go over some of the other news from foodworldorder.com and cyberspacewar.com, two other sites in the media monarchy kingdom. And on last week's episode 158, we spent a great amount of time covering new alternative media that Media Monarchy has a hand in. And we have a lot more follow-ups and updates, but I didn't want to be too repetitive in the mainline show. So what I want to tell you, last week when we talked about the new documentary from Richard Grove and Divergent Films and TragedyandHope.com and PeaceRevolution.org, it's called 2020 Hindsight, Censorship on the Front Line. Last week, we played the intro. The audio was out. We now have the entire video posted up as a playlist on YouTube. You can also grab a higher quality MP4 that, again, if you're subscribed to feeds.feedburner.com/Media Monarchy, you'll get all the audio and shows and the videos. That's the key. So we have the entire video, 2020 Hindsight, posted up under the headline, Wall Street Whistleblower Proves Money Never Sleeps. And what we're doing is presaging the upcoming Oliver Stone sequel to Wall Street. And I believe its subtitle will be Money Never Sleeps. So we can get this meme out ahead of time. And what we've talked about, and with the release of this film, that what Richard Grove and Paul Verge are doing is, if you donate $10 to Maria.net, GnosticMedia.com, DeadlineLive.info, MediaMonarchy.com, CorbettReport.com, or ThinkFree.ca, you get a high-quality DVD packed with tons of informational extras. What I swore last week was that I was going to go set up a bank account. And I did. It's almost all set up. I just have to set up the online part, and then I'm going to tie in, you know, PayPal or chip in or what have you. So it's a new separate bank account. I will also, in just a few short days, have a P.O. box set up. So I'm not ready to full-on unleash all that info, because I don't actually have it. I don't know what the P.O. box is yet. But it's reserved and paid for. I just have to show them my identification. So we're mentioning all this here on the B-side in relation to the alternative news projects that MediaMonarchy.com's involved in. So I imagine what'll happen next week on episode 160, when everything's set up, I'll do a bigger announcement and give the P.O. box and talk about little Media Monarchy Money March. So we went all over it last week, but again, I just want to implore you to start spreading and sharing 2020 Hindsight. Again, peacerevolution.org. And we also have, and again, some of these things are, we're doubling and redoubling the redundancy. The fourth episode from peacerevolution.org is the version of the three-way conversation between myself, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and Richard Grove of TragedyandHope.com. I posted it up when we covered it last week. Signal to Noise, a conversation on the media. Educating ourselves to live versus amusing ourselves to death. So speaking of James Corbett, we also have the latest episode of The New World next week. It just went up yesterday for February 25th. It's the 20th edition. And as you may know, the 10-minute video series I've been doing with James Corbett since about October of last year. Nice, concise, three stories with the documentation for you to go do more research for yourself. On this latest episode, we go over some of the things we're going to go over on this B-side, and I believe some other things we're going to go over in the upcoming episode 159. The three stories: school spied on kids via webcams on school-supplied laptops. Number two, Obama rebrands Iraq War as Operation New Dawn. In the third story, on 81st birthday, Oregon man gives company to employees. And again, as always, we implore you to please share and rate and comment and promote these videos on YouTube. Add them to your website. Share them on your social network site. Each episode's getting about 1,500, 2,000 hits. If everybody told somebody, We could double it, and again, redouble it. That's what we're trying to do. We've got the latest podcast episode from CorporateReport.com, episode 118, asking the question, who owns your DNA? On episode 118, Corporate discusses the tightening DNA control grid. Empowered by our own interest and enforced by the law, we're being cataloged at birth without our knowledge or consent. Again, on this episode, they talk DNA databases with Greg Nicoletos of WeThePeopleWillNotBeChipped.com and delve even deeper into the dark motives driving the agenda. We've seen mainstream regional reports come out about DNA databases, the latest all coming from Texas, but it's not just happening in Texas, it's happening all around the world. And when you discover the connections between that and companies like IBM, Corporate Report has also been doing a Sunday update video as part of the podcast. This latest episode knocked it out of the park. Israel's Nukes, Underwear Patsy, and Beck the Truther. Excellent cutting stories. Of course, everyone thinks Iran has nukes. They say they don't. They signed the non-proliferation treaty. Israel never signed that treaty and lies about the fact that they have a ton of nukes. The Underwear Patsy, we know we've pretty much fully destroyed that official story. He was helped and shepherded and handled every step of the way. And, of course, clips of Glenn Beck several months ago asking 9/11 truth questions, even though now he's turned around and tried to smear Deborah Medina in the gubernatorial campaign in Texas, and it ties in with Rick Perry and who gave money to who and who's going to smear who, making people touch the third rail of 9/11 truth. So, we also have the latest episode from Alex Ansari and Outside the Box. AlexAnsari.com. Outside the Box runs here on Portland Community Media on the Cable Access Television Channel. And you can get it in YouTube. I have the playlist posted up. This latest episode features Clyde Lewis. Now, of course, myself, Clyde Lewis, and Alex Ansari were all recently on KUFO 101.1 FM here in Portland. That episode's up. We covered that last week in the alternative media. And I note that for the last several months, I've been remiss in not posting up the TV shows and radio shows from Alex Ansari from right here in Portland, Oregon. His show on Oracle Broadcasting. He started a new show on LibertyNewsRadio.com. So I post up episode 238, Clyde Lewis, Alex Ansari, talking about the latest killing by the police of an unarmed black man in Portland, Oregon, and then the subsequent visit to Portland by Jesse Jackson, escalating it into a huge racially charged incident. We also have the latest article from Clyde Lewis and GroundZeroMedia.org, a project for the new American Manifesto Destiny. This, I believe, was the topic on the most recent Ground Zero episode with Clyde Lewis on KUFO.com. But I haven't gotten the audio. I don't have a clip of it, so I can't play anything for you right now. When it becomes available through ZeroPointRadio.com or CascadiaPublicRadio.org, it'll be added to this entry, Project for the New American Manifesto Destiny. It's an amazingly long article, basically charting the rising tensions, both inner and outer. So, in addition to Ground Zero Media www.thefragshipepisode.org. We also want to mention the videos. That's what I'm trying to say. GroundZeroTV.org. My man Mohawk Mike has been videoing, I believe, all the shows so far that Clyde's been doing on KUFO. And again, that's a big 50,000-watt rock station here in Portland, Oregon. Blast out all over the state. I believe his ratings are in, and he's beating Loveline and George Norrie, which is fantastic news. So all those videos are up, and KUFO is letting Ground Zero post these videos, which is great of them. So again, groundzerotv.org. We want to throw a huge hat tip out to Mike for that, and perhaps highlight it more in the not-too-distant future. So, having said all that, my friends, I know, plug, plug, plug. Let's jump to the other sites. We're going to hit all the latest on cyberspacewar.com. I started this site back in June of 2009. Now here we are at the end of February 2010. And I started this site because of what we've seen since the Obama meme. Cyberspace war, inner space and outer space. So much going on, prepping us for 2012 and beyond. But let's not get that grandiose right now. Let's start with something pretty simple that you can understand. And that, fortunately, the story blew up, shining a light on just the outrageous police state activities. We're grabbing this article from PCWorld.com. School spied on kids via webcams on school-supplied laptops. In case you haven't been following the plot of WebcamGate, starring the Lower Marion School District in southeastern Pennsylvania and a cast of thousands, here's the skinny. Last week, the Robbins family, whose son Blake attends Harrington High, filed a class action suit against the district, alleging that it's been spying on its students via webcams on school-supplied MacBooks. The suit came about after last November. To discuss, Blake Robbins was called into the assistant principal Lindy Matsko's office last November to discuss inappropriate behavior he was displaying at home. The proof? A snapshot of him taken with his laptop's webcam. Apparently, assistant principal Matsko thought Blake was popping pills. According to Robbins, he was merely eating candy. Mike and Ike's, to be precise. A classic gateway drug. Before you know it, he'll be deep into Good and Plenty's and then totally hooked on Tic Tacs. The idea that the school could peer into the Robbins home and by implication the homes of nearly 2,400 other students in the district blew their minds. It also may have, you know, violated dozens of federal and state laws regarding privacy, wiretapping, and electronic communications as alleged in their suit, with a PDF link for you to download. The school district's response? Yes. We have the ability to activate students' webcams remotely, but it's strictly used for tracking lost or stolen laptops, says school superintendent Dr. Christopher W. McGinley. No, we didn't tell any of the students or their families about it. Sorry. Our bad. Interestingly enough, while the district failed to inform parents about the technology, it did take the time to create a nice video praising the remote access features of the software, which is now called Absolute Manage, which it created for MacEnterprise.org in June 2008. The latest update we have on this by way of ArsTechnica.com is that the school district has pledged to keep all the evidence involved in WebcamGate.
The FBI is now investigating allegations that a Pennsylvania school district spied on students. The Lower Merion School District outside Philadelphia issued new laptops to students to help them with their studies. But one student said he was hauled into an administrator's office to explain his improper behavior at home. The school official then provided a picture snapped from the webcam on the student's school-issued laptop. And as Claudia Rivera of NBC affiliate WCAU explains, this week the student's parents filed a federal class action lawsuit.
Taking it all, you know, in stride.
Michael Robbins talking about his son, a student at Harrington High, whose school-issued MacBook has landed the Lower Merion School District in hot water.
We're really upset. It's not, you know, it's not conduct you expect from a school district.
The Robbins filed a federal class action lawsuit this week, accusing the district of violating privacy, civil rights, as well as federal and state wiretapping laws for allegedly using webcams to spy on students. Mark Haltman is the family's attorney.
Who has the access to these pictures, and what's happening with those pictures, and who's making the decision?
In a statement, district officials admit the laptops do contain a security feature intended to track lost, stolen, and missing laptops. But Haltman says Blake's computer was neither lost or stolen when the school activated his webcam and allegedly saw him engaged in improper behavior at home.
They were trying to allege that when Blake was holding two Mike and Ikes in his hand, which he apparently loves and eats religiously, that those were pills and somehow was involved in selling drugs.
The school district has since deactivated the feature, but the Robbins family is taking this one step further.
We filed today a request for an injunction so that we can get a court order to prevent the school district from continuing to activate the webcam.
So if you hadn't heard this story, I implore you to spread it. This hits people right at home. But continuing on cyberspacewar.com, the next post is a news purge. DEF CON 225 posted yesterday, February 25th. Cryptome, Catastrophe, Echelon, and CERN. The original story, Microsoft takes down whistleblower site Cryptome.org. That's CRYPTOME.org. Microsoft managed to do what a room full of secretive three-letter government agencies have wanted to do for years. Get the whistleblowing government document sharing site Cryptome.org shut down. Microsoft dropped a DMCA notice alleging copyright infringement on Cryptome's proprietor John Young after he posted a Microsoft surveillance compliance document that the company gives to law enforcement agents seeking information on Microsoft users. John Young of Cryptome filed a counterclaim arguing he had fair use to publish the document a day before the Thursday deadline set by his hosting provider, Network Solutions. The fortunate update coming from theregister.co.uk. Microsoft rescinded the copyright complaint that resulted in the shutdown of the long-standing whistleblower site Cryptome.org after it published Redmond's Spy Guide for Law Enforcement. War on whistleblowers. That seems to be a theme in a meme. Again from the Register, cyber attacks will catastrophically spook public. A digital attack against the UK causing even more damage would have a catastrophic effect on public confidence in the government, GCHQ has privately warned Whitehall. The Cheltenham Spy Agency's new Cybersecurity Operations Center makes the prediction in a document prepared for Cabinet Office and seen by the Register. A successful cyber attack against public services would have a catastrophic impact on public confidence in the government, even if the actual damage caused by the attack were minimal. Psychological effect. That's what we've been talking about since the start of cyberspacewar.com, is that a catalyzing catastrophic event with the web, with ATMs, with the power grid. They have an iPatriot Act sitting on the shelf, waiting for just such an event. Intel was also hit by those cyber attacks a few weeks ago that were hitting Google. More on that from esecurityplanet.com. Interesting not only article, but also a new site, at least new to me recently, conspiringtimes.com, the PlayStation 3, the future of Big Brother surveillance, question. And there's a video that goes along with that about the supercomputing powers of the PS3. So speaking of those Google attacks, Chinese programmer fingered in Google attacks. That's from ArsTechnica.com, and more from Threat Level. U.S. pinpoints coder behind Google attack. It's apparently, supposedly, a young Chinese guy. Echelon computers can't cope with bad lines. We've seen the meme Echelon popping back up lately. Again from the Register. Who remembers Echelon? The top secret telecommunications spy network said to be run by the U.S. and allied Anglophone nations and to be triggered as soon as certain keywords or phrases are spoken on the phone. A lot of you would guess, so it's interesting to note that Pentagon has now stated that perhaps the most intriguing, reputed capability of Echelon, the ability to automatically pick out words of interest and flag that conversation up as important to its human masters, doesn't work. Or, anyway, it only works on good, clear lines. A noisy or degraded signal frustrates it. The news comes as part of a solicitation from the Pentagon Crazy Tech Bureau, DARPA, in which the Maverick Military Mayhem Mavens request assistance with building a robust automatic transcription of speech system. RATS. Robust automatic transcription of speech. We recently had the Echelon meme pop back up, because I believe the building that Joe Stack allegedly crashed his plane into in Austin recently was the Echelon building, so-called. Italian verdict on Google privacy sets dangerous precedent. That's as well from ArsTechnica.com. We've been following the Italian government's fight against web freedom. Do you think that maybe has anything to do with essentially Silvio Berlusconi being basically, I believe I explained it to someone who was like, imagine if Ted Turner were president of the U.S. That's the kind of media control. Or if Rupert Murdoch were the prime minister of Australia. Global treaty may make your ISP spy on you. That's from Short Sharp Science blog on NewScientist.com. As if everything we already know, as if... sometimes this gets so ridiculous, saying, oh, they might spy on you. As if they're not doing it already and haven't been for quite a long time. The last note on this news purge posting on cyberspacewar.com, Krypton Catastrophe, Echelon, and CERN. That's right, a Large Hadron Collider in multi-magnet hiccup. Again, from the tongue-in-cheek writers at the fantastic theregister.co.uk. A technical hiccup has delayed the planned restart of the Large Hadron Collider, the Titanic subterranean magno donut particle smasher situated deep beneath the Franco-Swiss border. The LHC, the most outrageous matter-rending machine ever assembled by the human race, had been expected to fire up its circulating hadron beams once more following the Christmas break today. That being yesterday, Thursday, February 25th. When, oh when, will CERN fire up again, and what will it connect to in the crazy cyberspace war? The Norway Spiral, Project Bluebeam, audio spotlights, holographic projections. We've covered all these topics all over cyberspacewar.com, as well as MediaMonarchy.com, and again, I would implore you to go check out some of those phrases I just talked about. Project Bluebeam and holographic projections. A follow-up on the recent terror cyber drill, cyber shockwave. CNN, of course, was connected to this at the hip. They shot it and basically ran it on television as a special. CNN broadcast major cyber shockwave propaganda. They rolled it out last weekend on the 20th and 21st. It's called Cyber Shockwave. We were warned. And it posits a cyber attack on the U.S. How should the government deal with the threat? Federalize the National Guard to deal with unruly mobs freaking out over the loss of electricity? Nationalize utility companies so the NSA and the government get electricity? The participants also recommend new powers be granted to the president. Not surprisingly, they declared the president has the authority to take unprecedented action against the states and the private sector under the Constitution. CNN and the participants agreed that this slick propaganda presentation is aimed directly at the American people. Thanks to Researchers 2 up on YouTube.com, we have the entire playlist. We don't know exactly how long that'll last if CNN will complain and YouTube will yank it. But all nine parts are connected up there, posted up there, embedded up there. But as I've told you, in my preparations and creations and production of MediaMonarchy.com, the site and the show, I save everything, download everything, print a PDF of everything, burn it off, archive it. CNN's simulated cyber attack war game, We Were Warned. We also have the two flashbacks back to the one post on Cyberspace War and the other on Media Monarchy. Miltech insiders stage cyber shockwave and former U.S. officials in cyber attack simulation. And the hype grows louder. That will be another meme we'll follow throughout these episodes this weekend. From FederalTimes.com, former Intel chief predicts devastating cyber attack. The country is not taking cybersecurity seriously and will fall victim to a devastating cyber attack within the next few years, former National Intelligence Director Mike McConnell told lawmakers Tuesday. Mike McConnell being the former National Intelligence Director, Dennis Blair being the current DNI. We talked about Dennis Blair and basically the revelation of the method that they can assassinate American citizens abroad, you know, if they're terrorists. So here we have the former DNI Mike McConnell talking about the coming I-9/11. Continuing. Disagreements over whether the federal government or private companies should take the lead in developing cybersecurity protocols is making the situation worse, McConnell testified before the Senate, Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee, linked to their press release on commerce.senate.gov. If the nation went to war today in a cyber war, we would lose. We will not mitigate this risk. We'll talk about it. We'll wave our arms. We'll have a bill, but we are not going to mitigate this risk. As a result, we will have a catastrophic event. Quote. McConnell also said he strongly favors the Gov playing a larger role in cybersecurity because a major cyber attack would cripple commerce and shake consumers' confidence in the financial markets and the federal government, rivaling the damage of a nuclear attack to the country. When transactions involve billions of dollars or route trains up and down the East Coast, the basic attributes of security must be endorsed. Others argue that the government should spur the markets and private companies to develop solutions because the government moves too slowly. Quoting Scott Borg, director and chief economist at the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit, USCCU.us, an independent nonprofit cybersecurity research group, saying, quote, if the government tries to mandate standards, they'll be out of date and an actual impediment to better security before they can be applied. This is not like fire codes in building construction where the big changes can take decades. We don't know what the minimum code for cybersecurity should look like 4 years from now. But the federal government can't trust companies to have the goodwill to protect their systems, said James Lewis, director and senior fellow for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. If 10% of companies don't do the right thing, 100% will be vulnerable. Senate Commerce Committee Chairman John D. Rockefeller IV, Democrat from my home state of West Virginia, and ranking member Olympia Snow, Republican from Maine, introduced a cybersecurity bill back in March of 2009 that would create a Senate-confirmed, cabinet-level national cybersecurity leader. Snow said the current cyber czar, ex-Microsoft and Bush insider Howard Schmidt, lacks accountability and the power to make game-changing policy. The Rockefeller-Snow bill, S-773, is one of several cybersecurity bills lingering in Congress. The House already passed a cybersecurity bill earlier this month, expanding cybersecurity research programs. We have an update article from the Huffington Post, James D. Zirin writing and asking again the musical question, are we on the brink of a cyber war? Again, hopefully you're catching things in the data mining that we do on cyberspacewar.com and Media Monarchy. You'll start to see the keywords and phrases pop up. We're seeing echelon and catastrophic events. Nukes, East Coast, drills. But we'll end our coverage from cyberspacewar.com with a, I suppose, slightly funnier story that comes from allgov.com. And I'll tell you right here again, since this seems to be the smaller show with a more select audience, I'll go ahead and tell you here that I'm working on having an interview very soon with someone from allgov.com. PleaseRobMe.com uses Twitter to tell when people aren't home. And the creators of PleaseRobMe.com really aren't out to steal from people, they insist. Rather, they want to educate people about the dangers of posting too much info on social network sites before they become victims of unscrupulous types. Using info posted by people on Twitter, PleaseRobMe.com can show when people aren't home, making them vulnerable to burglaries. The Netherlands-based designers rely on details provided online by players of Foursquare, who are known to tweet about their actual locations while playing the online game. Van Amstel, one of Please Rob Me's designers, told BBC that it's easy to create a site like this and stressed that they're doing it as a public service. The website is not a tool for burglary. The point we're getting at is that not long ago, it was questionable to share your full name on the internet. We've gone past that point by 1,000 miles. Interesting follow-ups from CNET and the BBC and the CBC and the Times Online. Fascinatingly enough, there was an article recently in, I think, just the Metro Living or whatever it's called section of the New York Times, and they were talking about people playing Foursquare and Twittering about it. So, as I do when I'm looking at the dinosaur newspapers while I'm on lunch at work, I grab my little pen and give people the contextual supplemental information. In this case, PleaseRobMe.com. So that does it for CyberspaceWar.com. Let's now blast through all the latest on FoodWorldOrder.com. The first is a news purge. The Binge and Purge, posted yesterday, 225, Corn, Codex, Hot Dogs, and Walmart. First from Food Freedom, 13 million acres of GMO corn illegally planted in the U.S. A fascinating story from foodsafetynews.com about 10 years of bribery and bad tomatoes. In 10 years of tomato racketeering and bribery, it was probably inevitable that food safety would take a backseat at California-based SK Foods. But with a federal grand jury indictment Thursday of the former owner and CEO of SK Foods, it became clear that willfully selling impure food was a central aspect of the racketeering enterprise. McCain's dietary supplement bill is yet another attempt to implement what is known as Codex Alimentarius. I believe we discussed that quite recently on foodworldorder.com. It's essentially the food rule book outlawing natural remedies again, because if it grows naturally, you can't patent it. You can't make money off of it. Pop artist pleads guilty to misbranding. This is a nice little case of a little bit of culture jamming. A guy changing labels of Gatorade bottles with Tiger Woods on it saying unfaithful. Basically sounds like he's just also trying to pimp himself out to get commercial advertising work. An interesting piece from naturalnews.com. Choking on hot dogs? It's not the shape, it's the ingredients. The American Academy of Pediatrics was making headlines this past week with bizarre recommendations that hot dogs should be reshaped to make them less of a choking hazard for children. However, there's no mention of all the cancer-causing chemical ingredients that actually go into the hot dogs. Pediatric physicians are apparently more concerned about the shape than the ingredients, and they apparently have no concern about the truth that hot dogs contain cancer-causing ingredients. Document link, Daily Mail, cancer.gov, naturalnews.com, on and on and on. Finally, from theatlantic.com, the interesting article and video, The Great Grocery Smackdown. Will Walmart save the family farm and make us all healthy? They go to a Walmart and actually go, wow, this food really? There's a lot of stuff here. And if that doesn't make you sick, this certainly will. Again, from foodsafetynews.com, telling you you might want to rethink your drink. Studies find that some soda fountain machines and lemon wedges in restaurants contain fecal matter. A study conducted in Roanoke Valley, Virginia, reveals that nearly half of all sodas dispensed from a sample of 30 machines contained coliform bacteria. Coliform bacteria is a group of bacteria banned in drinking water by the EPA because it indicates the possibility of fecal contamination. Late last year, a New Jersey microbiologist tested lemons at 21 restaurants and found disease-causing bacteria on two-thirds of the lemon, including fecal bacteria. ABC News conducted their own small study by going undercover at three major restaurant chains in Jersey. Lemon wedges from TGIF, Applebee's, and Chili's were swabbed and sent to NYU's medical center. Findings revealed that four samples contained the matter, including one with E. coli. Interesting comment from Wendy Warren, talking about Michelle Obama, with a blog post on whitehouse.gov talking about eliminating food deserts. Of course, Michelle Obama and her sludge-filled organic farm garden on the White House. One of the first stories we covered on Food World Order, which is coming up actually on its first birthday in about a week or so. Two more stories here on this B-Side, episode 158 from MediaMonarchy.com, February 26th, 2010. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show at MediaMonarchy.com. We've been covering the alternative news, CyberspaceWar.com, and we're on FoodWorldOrder.com, the little-told story of how the U.S. government poisoned alcohol during Prohibition. This is an amazing article from Slate.com from the writer Deborah Blum. She was doing it to do research on a book of hers, which we have linked up, the name of which escapes me at the moment. We'll get to it in just a second. This story proves yet again that governments will kill their own citizens. It was Christmas Eve, 1926. The streets aglitter with snow and lights. when the man afraid of Santa Claus stumbled into the emergency room at New York City's Bellevue Hospital. He was flushed, gasping with fear. Santa Claus, he kept telling the nurses, was just behind him wielding a baseball bat. Before hospital staff realized how sick he was, the alcohol-induced hallucination was just a symptom, the man died. So did another partygoer. And another. As dusk fell on Christmas, the hospital staff tallied up more than 60 people made desperately ill by alcohol and 8 dead from it. Within the next 2 days, yet another 23 people died in the city from celebrating the season. Doctors were accustomed to alcohol poisoning by then, the routine of life in the Prohibition era. The bootlegged whiskeys and so-called gins often made people sick. The liquor produced in hidden stills frequently came tainted with metals and other impurities. But this outbreak was bizarrely different. The deaths, as investigators would shortly realize, came courtesy of the U.S. government. Frustrated that people continued to consume so much alcohol even after it was banned, federal officials then decided to try a different kind of enforcement. They ordered the poisoning of industrial alcohols manufactured in the United States, products regularly stolen by bootleggers and resold as drinkable spirits. The idea was to scare people into giving up illicit drinking. Instead, by the time Prohibition ended in 1933, the federal poisoning program, by some estimates, had killed at least 10,000 people. Although mostly forgotten today, the Chemists' War of Prohibition remains one of the strangest and most deadly decisions in American law enforcement history. As one of its most outspoken opponents, Charles Norris, the chief medical examiner of New York City during the 20s, liked to say, "It was our national experiment in extermination." Poisonous alcohol still kills. 16 people died just this month after drinking lethal booze in Indonesia, where bootleggers make their own brews to avoid steep taxes. But that's more due to unscrupulous businessmen rather than government order. I learned of the federal poisoning program while researching my new book, The Poisoner's Handbook, which is set in Jazz Age New York. My first reaction was that I must have gotten it wrong. I never heard that government poisoned people during Prohibition, did you? I kept saying to friends, family members, and colleagues. I did, however, remember the U.S. government's controversial decision in the 1970s to spray Mexican marijuana fields with paraquat, an herbicide. P-A-R-A-Q-U-A-T. Its use was primarily intended to destroy crops, but government officials also insisted that awareness of the toxin would deter marijuana smokers. They echoed the official position of the 20s. If some citizens ended up poisoned, well, they'd brought it upon themselves. Although paraquat wasn't really all that toxic, the outcry forced the government to drop the plan. Still, the incident created an unsurprising lack of trust in government motives, which reveals itself in the occasional rumor circulating today that federal agencies such as the CIA mix poison into the illegal drug supply. During Prohibition, however, an official sense of higher purpose kept the poisoning program in place. As the Chicago Tribune editorialized in 1927, quote, "Normally, no American government would engage in such business. It is only in the curious fanaticism of prohibition that any means, however barbarous, are considered justified." Others, however, accused lawmakers opposed to the poisoning plan of being in cahoots with criminals and argued that bootleggers and their law-breaking alcoholic customers deserve no sympathy. "Must Uncle Sam guarantee safety first for souses?" asked Nebraska's Omaha Bee. Proving yet again that governments will kill its own citizens. The little told story of how the U.S. government poisoned alcohol during Prohibition. Again, that book is called The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York. Again, by Deborah Blum. That whole article is posted in its entirety on foodworldorder.com. Just make sure you've clicked the Read More, See the Complete Post link. As I've told you several times now, trying to remind you. Experimenting with some of the layout features on the website. I don't want to blow up my front page with big, long articles, so you insert a piece of code and it breaks right there, and you have to click the drop down to see the rest of the story. The rest of the story. Let's end the rest of this story with some good news. This story also got lots of positive reactions in the mainstream media, on my Facebook posting, all of that. From the Seattle Times, on 81st birthday, Oregon man gives company to employees. Scores of employees gathered to help Bob Moore celebrate his 81st birthday last week at the company that bears his name, Bob's Red Mill Natural Foods, bobsredmill.com. Bob Moore, whose mutual love of healthful eating and old-world technologies spawned an internationally distributed line of products, responded with a gift of his own. The whole company. The employee stock ownership plan, with a link for you, that Moore unveiled means that his 209 employees now own the place and its 400 offerings of stone ground flours, cereals, and bread mixes. This is Bob taking care of us. He expects a lot out of us, but he really gives us the world in return, said Lori Sobelson, who runs the business's retail op. Bob Moore declined to say how much he thinks the company's worth. In 2004, one business rag estimated the year's revenue at more than $24 million. A company news release issued last week stated that Bob's Red Mills chalked up an annual growth rate of between 20 and 30% every year since. Now, I stole the clip from ABC News and posted it up to youtube.com/MediaMonarchy. It doesn't have many views. Again, I implore you to please share, comment, spread, download, re-upload, post, comment, favorite, playlist, whatever. We're going to go out with the clip that I stole from ABC News about Bob's Red Mill. I've noted on the recent New World Next Week that in my line of work, I handle Bob's Red Mill all the time. It's a good economic story. It's a good food story. So my friends, as I've said, I want you to get active or get radioactive. Take care.
And now, from the American heart, a story we really love. Hope you do, too. This week, the 200 employees of Bob's Red Mill in Portland, Oregon, came to work as usual to grind the flour, drive the forklift, greet the customers, only to learn that their boss was giving them the company he had built from scratch with his own money. It was a gift worth hundreds of thousands of dollars for each employee, including the janitors, from a man who had once lost everything he owned and knew the terror of not being able to pay a bill. Bob Moore says he decided that in America, the company really belongs to the people who make it possible in the first place.
Here's what I know about America. It's probably the only place in the world I could have this wonderful opportunity of being in business, making mistakes, failing, then succeeding. You know, really, when you think about it, a lot of companies are passed on within the family. That's how I think about it. It's just part of the family. I have employees with me right now that have been with me for 30 years. They just were committed to staying with me. And now the logical thing is they're going to own the company.
Well, how's it going?
Good.
It's the only business decision that I could make. I could not sell the company. I could not sell the company. I don't think there's anybody worthy to run this company but the people who built it. There's a lot of negative stuff going into business today. It's a good old basic Bible lesson, and that is that the love of money is the root of all evil. And unfortunately, our entire philosophy today is just to get all the money you can in whatever way you can. It's caused people to do a lot of things just for money that they feel in their hearts is not the right thing to do. I've just truly tried to set some of that aside and do what I thought was the best thing for the group of people who made this all possible. America, I guess it's sort of an experiment, but it's one of the most wonderful experiments that man has ever taken on. I keep hoping for the best. Maybe we'll brighten up the day for a few people that watch it. And this is part of that. This should be the good part of America.
How would you explain it?
Combining music and stylized images.
I mean, so it's all remote control.
Each one of those images was electronically based.
Say out on my threat.
And that concludes our program for tonight.
Yep.
This could really catch on.
I can't remember when I've been so moved.